Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, it's Francis. The holidays are here. It's the middle of Hanukkah, Christmas, and then Kwanzaa are right around the corner. Hope you and yours are having a lovely time. To help with that, here's a show from last year that's got a quiet moment for poetry and reflection, a whole slew of desserts, and dreams of festive family and friends somewhere really warm. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. What are you giving this holiday season? Well, this show is our gift to you. A raucous Christmas in Puerto Rico, a long supply of sweets to snack on, and a moment to slow down with poetry and reflection. Sounds pretty good, right? It sounds like a dream to me, so let's get to it. Von Diaz is a multi-talented reporter, editor, producer, writer, teacher, and cookbook author. And she's reported many stories for this show over the years, including one of my absolute favorites, when she spent a day with Jorge Muñoz Zapata, a man sometimes called the Angel of Queens, who was a school bus driver who spends all his off hours cooking and serving free meals to hungry people in the street. It's really, really terrific. You should check it out. Anyway, we've wanted to catch up with Vaughn for a while, and really because we want to know what Christmas was like for her as a kid. Growing up in Atlanta with family in Puerto Rico, where Christmas is a real party. Hey, Vaughn.
Hey, Francis.
Oh, I'm so happy to talk with you. It's been so long.
Yes, it has.
Yeah. But, you know, it's actually, since we're talking about so long ago, I want to start this by going way back in my memory. And actually, to the point, I don't really remember when this happened. But many years ago, I had this like sudden and kind of mind-blowing realization about Christmas. Because I grew up in New Jersey, and the whole time growing up, you know, of course, Christmas was all about dreaming of a white Christmas and snow and Frosty the Snowman and pine trees. And it wasn't until a zillion years later, I think maybe I was in Florida or Texas or something for Christmas one year, I look around and I see all the same stuff in ads and, you know, people's decorations. And I realized, you know, if you grew up here, you've probably never actually seen snow. You know, but all the Christmas visual culture every year for someone growing up, say, in the South, it's almost like another Halloween, right? It's like you're dressing up like it's going to be snowy and pine trees. And like, that's just not part of your, you know, that doesn't naturally exist where you are. So I wanted to ask you, as someone who grew up in Atlanta and would often visit family in Puerto Rico, what Christmas was like for you growing up?
Gosh, in both places, Christmas was something that we were really excited to celebrate in my family.
Sure.
And if I was in the South, I would say that it was, you know, chilly, right? But I have no memory of there ever being snow on the ground at Christmas in, sure, in Georgia. And in Puerto Rico, Christmas was hot. Pretty humid, and arguably much more exuberant than the Christmases that I celebrated in the South.
So emotionally hot.
Definitely. And I, you know, it's like I always very proudly like to say that Puerto Ricans are loud people. It's something I think that we hold as a kind of pride. So everything in Puerto Rico feels louder to me than it does anywhere else. And I would say the same is true for Christmas. There's more decorations. The music is really exuberant. But definitely not a bit of snow.
Yeah, I don't expect that there. But so, okay, so tell me about like, okay, so you would go to Puerto Rico for Christmas often, right? I think you said you would often go there at that time to visit family.
Mm-hmm.
What would that be like when you got there, when you landed? What would you expect? What were you excited about? Like, set the scene for us.
Sure. So I think like a lot of Puerto Rican families who live stateside, my family often visited Puerto Rico for the holidays, right? So it was either Thanksgiving or Christmas, and usually we would rotate. And mm-hmm. as a kid, my travels to Puerto Rico were so incredibly exciting. And I always, you know, I'd be excited to see my family. But, you know, as we were boarding the plane, I would already be thinking about all of the delicious things that I was going to eat. Empanadas, quesitos, which are a kind of pastry that's filled with cheese, guava, all sorts of tropical fruit. And then the sort of quintessential flavors of Puerto Rico, heavily seasoned, nice and salty and garlicky and porky, lots of fried things, root vegetables, you know, things that are, to me, decidedly earthy flavors, in very much in contrast to the, you know, the food that I had access to in the South. And also what I sort of think of as kind of classic American holiday food, which is often creamy, right? Like there's often like a lot of dairy, a lot of cream and cheeses and things of that sort.
Buttery mashed potatoes, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And those are just not ingredients that we use a ton in Puerto Rican cuisine. So, yeah, I mean, I remember many times because we went to Puerto Rico for Christmas often. And typically we would go for a week or two. And unlike other people's Christmases, right, who didn't go to Puerto Rico, we had plans to go to the beach, right? Like I always had to bring a new swimsuit. And we would arrive at the airport in San Juan, in something that actually I've seen is a continuing trend at that airport, which is that even though people can't go into the airport in the way that they could when I was a kid, families just line up, right? And like wait for their family members to arrive on the other side of a barricade, just like so excited. And I'll also say that, you know, when I was growing up, air travel was more expensive, right? Sure. And it was like a big deal to go to Puerto Rico. Today I can, you know, I'm there in 3.5 hours and it's super easy. But as a kid, it was a challenging trip. And I remember my grandmother would greet us with a fresh loaf of bread. And Christmas decorations were just all over the airport, Christmas music pouring out of people's cars. Something that I've always loved about my culture, particularly around Christmas, is that our Christmas music is really hype. Right. Yeah. It's not like there's no like silent night. Nobody is singing softly. Right. It's exuberant. It's fun. There's tambores and güiros and cuatros and, you know, rhythms of bomba y plena and, you know, and sort of songs that might sound to some people like a salsa or a merengue, because those are the rhythms of our culture. Right. And so they fed into our Christmas songs as well. You know, I just remember arriving in Puerto Rico and it being very clear that Christmas was a big deal.
Yeah. You know, it sounds like a party.
Exactly. One of the most, a really traditional practice is what's called a parranda. And it is our form of Christmas caroling that is as exuberant as the music. So sort of in the same fashion, and this is something that that I saw when I was a kid. People would stop through my grandmother's house to do this. A group of people would get together, some people singing, some people with instruments, and would just, you know, walk from house to house, offering some kind of, you know, really, really fun, really lively music, and then would be subsequently invited in to have, you know, like a little dessert or perhaps, you know, a glass of coquito, you know, which is coconut eggnog. And it's just so, so fun and loving and such a sense of community to this practice. And I think that's part of why the music is so exciting, you know, because it's like, you need all of these people to play all of these instruments to create this sound that epitomizes, a holiday that people just really love on the island.
Okay, we've knocked on the door a little bit talking about the food, so I'm just gonna like bust right through because I've been waiting for this. You mentioned empanadas, you mentioned the coquito. What were the Christmas feasts for you like?
Oh goodness. So much food. So my grandmother, who you know, is my culinary muse, I mean, her house was the house you wanted to get invited to Christmas at. Right. Because not only was she an incredible cook, but she had such a flair for design and decoration. She had this massive collection of nutcrackers, some of which were like waist high, some of which were like little tiny ones that would like you'd put incense in them and they would smoke. I mean, I really don't know where this obsession with nutcrackers came from, but she loved them. And she, you know, would start cooking a couple days in advance. So the most, I would say the most traditional Christmas spread was always a pernil or roast pork. Mm-hmm. Which is typically seasoned with an adobo, usually garlic, olive oil, some kind of acid. Some people use vinegar, some people use sour orange, and oregano, salt and pepper. So deeply, deeply seasoned. You should always marinate a pork shoulder at least a day in advance. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we would marinate ours for 2 days, right? So it's like the flavors would really penetrate in there. Mm-hmm. And be so delicious and just fill the house with all this smell. So that was sort of the centerpiece, along with a few pretty typical sides, arroz con gandules or rice with pigeon peas, or sort of seasoned with sofrito, yuca or cassava, boiled and then sort of doused with a garlicky mojo, sometimes with like a super soft onions and olive oil.
Yes.
The most important fixture, though, for Christmas in Puerto Rico are pasteles. It's a kind of root vegetable tamale. And it actually is very similar to dishes that I've seen all over island communities, right? And so you start with a root vegetable base. It's usually taro, sometimes green plantain, and other root vegetables. Some people use yuca. And you spread that on a banana leaf that has like a little bit of oil, and then fill it with super deliciously seasoned little bits of pork. My family would often put chickpeas, pimentos, olives, and sometimes raisins, which I really like. And then that gets all wrapped up and then steamed inside the banana leaf. And it's an interesting dish because it is, I would argue that it's an acquired taste, right? It's a very interesting, strong tasting thing. The root vegetables, I think, are unfamiliar to folks who don't grow up eating them. The banana leaf also sort of infuses all of it with this like really kind of strong, earthy flavor that's unique. And then you've got all that stuff inside and the raisins that sort of pop with this sweetness. And the other thing about pasteles that I think folks often forget to mention is that they're really not pretty foods. They are. They sort of look like they're like a medium brown kind of rectangle that is a little bit it slips right off of the banana leaf and onto your plate. It doesn't necessarily look like a thing you want to eat at first, but they are so incredibly delicious and nourishing and filling. And to me, because they are traditionally prepared for Christmas, right, when you have many hands, when you have lots of people, family coming around that can help with the process, which is quite laborious, the flavor of pasteles is Christmas for me.
That's Vaughn Diaz, author of Coconuts and Collards, and we'll be back with more with her in just a bit. And then, holiday baking inspired by Louisiana, Paris, and New York, Valerie Lomas. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave, but sometimes it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful, and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net carb Hero croissant or the 1-gram net carb Hero cheddar biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're getting ready for the holidays today with Puerto Rican Christmas traditions, great baking, and a little slowdown poetry moment. But right now, let's get back to Von Diaz. This feast sounds tremendous. And, you know, a lot of the dishes you named are dishes I actually recognize from Puerto Rican restaurants, you know, here in New York City where I live.
Like, yeah.
Pernil is always a daily thing that's always available, like on the steam table. You know, pasteles might be a Thursday special. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that these are the festive foods. Like, those aren't everyday foods.
Yeah, definitely not. And this is something that's fascinated me for some time, because I think that, in fact, you're right. The many of the dishes that folks are most familiar with in Puerto Rico are holiday foods, are Thanksgiving and Christmas foods. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me sort of the way that much of the popular Mexican food that I think people are most familiar with, tacos, I think being the best example, right? That's a snack food. Mm-hmm. And many mm-hmm. of the most popular dishes that we're familiar with in Mexico are snack foods. And I believe that in part, it's because Christmas is a time, like the holidays were a time when a lot of Puerto Ricans would return home to visit family. Mm-hmm. And I've always sort of thought that the popularity of these particular dishes and their abundance sort of in restaurants and things, as you mentioned, comes as a result of folks really wanting to maintain a connection to the island, right? And to the excitement and the joy of that season that's so beloved. So I don't have any proof for this sort of in a scholarly way, but it's been my observation that, you know, the flavors of Puerto Rican Christmas food are so strong and so quintessential. They're steeped in tradition. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. it makes perfect sense to me, right, that when you're missing home or when you want to evoke a place that you miss, you would want to bring those flavors into your mouth, right?
Because
it's like a time portal immediately to like your favorite Christmas ever.
Yeah, yeah. What's for dessert?
Oh, goodness. Admittedly, I'm not a dessert person, although I don't think that was as true when I was a kid. But my grandmother made a number of things. My mother is also a very good dessert maker. Mm. Flan was almost always available, either what we call flan de queso, which usually has cream cheese in it,
or
flan de leche, which doesn't have cream cheese, which I prefer, flan made
with cream cheese?
Yes.
Come on, stop it.
A lot of flan actually has cream cheese. If it's like super creamy rich, next time you have a flan, if it's like just absurdly creamy, like a panna cotta, it probably has some cream cheese in it.
Oh God, that's awesome.
So we would have flan. My grandmother always made a really delicious bread pudding that was seasoned, you know, sort of flavored with cinnamon and cloves, rum cake. Was often a fixture at our holidays. Typically, what is sometimes called a Bacardi cake that has sort of toasted nuts on the top. And my mom makes hers with boxed cake mix, which is the way that I make it because it's stellar. And then doused with like this like brown sugar butter rum deliciousness that would then seep into it.
Hello.
Didn't I just say I wasn't a dessert person? And I'm like, oh God, the rum cake. And then coquito, which is our coconut eggnog. It is super delicious. And typically the flavors of coquito, although everybody has their own recipe, but I'll speak to mine, is coconut milk, vanilla, cinnamon, and a little lime zest. No nutmeg, as sort of American eggnogs typically have, and white rum as the liquor. And It was definitely something. Coquito was something that I really looked forward to as a kid because it's very easy to make it without alcohol, right? You just make a batch and then you add your own. Mm-hmm. And it was just, it was like liquid dessert, right? It was like dessert in a glass.
Oh God, that sounds so good. Sweet coconut milk with lime zest and cinnamon.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Well, this is super awesome, Vaughn. I'm so happy to get a chance to talk with you again. And I hope you have great holidays with lots of coquito.
Thanks, Francis. Same to you.
Vaughn Diaz is the author of Coconuts and Collards, Recipes and Stories from Puerto Rico to the Deep South. She teaches food studies and oral history at the University of North Carolina. You can find her recipe for coquito at splendidtable.org. So I truly cannot believe how much time I've spent over the last couple of years watching people bake on TV. And I always do it after dinner too, which, you know, keeps feeding this totally untenable desire to have multiple desserts every night. But it's December, so sure, have that extra cookie. And if you're going to have a second slice of cake, it really ought to be Cake by Valerie Lomas. Valerie was a career attorney who had a hardcore love of baking and just decided to put herself out there and ended up winning the Great American Baking Show. And I've got to know her recipes a little bit because we published her cookbook, and I am so excited to talk with her about them. Hey, Valerie. It's great to talk with you.
Hi, Frances. I'm so glad we are chatting today.
Me too. Hey, how are you planning on celebrating the holidays this year?
I am so excited to be celebrating with my family. I'm going to go to my hometown of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And, you know, it's just going to be extra special to gather with everyone this year and, you know, to be able to feel safe to do so. And of course, we're going to eat all of the good food, sing Christmas carols, all of that kind of stuff.
You're a caroling family? You sing together?
We are absolutely a caroling family. You know, like it. My sisters and I, we grew up playing piano and we were all in choir. Right. So we'll do Carol of the Bells and everyone will have their different part. Alto, soprano, we've got it all covered.
Oh, this is for real?
Oh, yeah.
And okay, you grew up in Baton Rouge. What were the holidays like growing up?
Yeah, I mean, so definitely this time of year, we're eating gumbo. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my family, we didn't eat that at the Christmas table, but we did eat that New Year's Eve for sure. Because in Louisiana, anytime it gets cold, it's gumbo season.
Sure.
But, you know, for Christmas, we kind of do a repeat Thanksgiving. Like we do turkey, we do all the fixings, we do all the desserts. So we've got cornbread dressing, candied yams, macaroni and cheese, collard greens, mustard greens, deviled eggs, and, you know, cakes, yes, pies, all that good stuff.
Yes, yes. You know, it's funny because I love the idea of the repeat Thanksgiving because it's like so many families do that. And I feel like so few families like talk about it that way. It's like, oh, it's another holiday. It's like, y'all, we did this 4 weeks ago. Like,
right.
And like, why does everyone freak out about it when it's on Thanksgiving and then like you do the same thing 4 weeks later and everyone's like, oh, it's cool, it's not a big deal, it's not hard, it's not like people freaking out about what they have to do. It's like, why does it feel like it's easy and normal and natural to do it when it's 4 weeks later? But I'm glad you're talking about it that way.
I think it's just, it's chill for Christmas because
right
there's other stuff going on that day, right? Mm-hmm. Santa came, you know, like there are gifts to open. And we also do like a breakfast. We do something like special for breakfast. And for me, you know, it's spiking my coffee with a little Irish cream. And, you know, my mom and I, we might make croissants or like a cheese souffle, like something really, really fun and a little over the top for breakfast.
Really? I like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's like for us, it's just a way that we can spend time together as a family. And that means laminating dough for a few hours.
Yeah, right on.
It's really fun.
Yeah, I love that your style seems to really be informed, like almost like equal parts Louisiana, New York, and Paris, which, you know, like, hello, I want to be your holiday party. But, you know, for those of us who will not taste treats made by your own hands, like, what should we make?
Yeah, you know, for the holidays, I love this pecan candy cheesecake. Mm-hmm. And when I created this recipe, It was for the finale of The Great American Baking Show. And I wanted something that was really festive. And for me, cheesecake, it's giving that, like, those Christmas vibes. But I wanted to make sure that my Louisiana roots were in there. Mm-hmm. So for the crust, I call it a pecan candy crust because it's got the ingredients you'll find in pecan candy, but it's a super simple press-in crust with pecans and brown sugar and melted butter. I mean, it couldn't be easier. And the cheesecake filling is, of course, an ode to New York City, my kind of adopted hometown where I've been living for the past 10 years. And what I love about this recipe is the cheesecake, it comes out just so perfectly clean. There's no cracked top or discoloration on top, and it's silky smooth. So the textures just pair so beautifully with that pecan candy crust.
Oh, cool. Okay, let me ask you this, because I'm not a super avid baker. And I love cheesecake, so I'll eat it like any which way, no matter how it looks. I've never baked a cheesecake that didn't crack. So how do you make it so the cheesecake doesn't crack?
Yeah, so what I do with my cheesecake is I cook it, you know, in a bain-marie. So I cook it in a water bath. Okay. And what that does is it ensures that it's cooking evenly all around. But also when I remove it from the oven so that I'm not like shocking it, I take it out of the oven, but I keep it in that hot water bath for about half an hour. And then I take it out of the hot water bath and keep it at room temperature for about half an hour. And then I let it finish resting in the refrigerator. So it's this kind of like slow way to really reduce the heat and finish that cooking. You don't just kind of cook it to oblivion while it's in the oven. It's got a real slow finish. Mm-hmm. And it makes it just super creamy, and it's beautiful on top. And another tip, because I'm cooking it in a water bath, and a lot of cheesecake recipes suggest that, but they also suggest for you to use a springform pan. Mm-hmm. And anyone who has done that and has gotten water in your springform pan, it's the worst. And
that just
I'm sorry.
Hurt my heart.
Right. Life doesn't have to be that hard. So I actually make my cheesecake in a square baking pan. You don't have to worry about water seeping through. And I do this thing where I cut out parchment paper strips that I layer in the pan before, you know, I add my crust and my filling. So that way, when it's done cooking, you just lift it out by the parchment paper strips. And it's like perfectly ready. You can slice it into like perfect squares or have cheesecake bars. And it looks beautiful. It tastes beautiful, which is what we want. I mean, it's the holidays. You want something on your table that's going to be the centerpiece. Of course, it's bake ahead. You're not like over the stove on Christmas morning. You do it. You can do it the day before or days before and have it chilling in the fridge.
Right on.
You know, when I bring this dessert places, if there are other desserts around, this is the one that disappears first. This is the one where people call me the next day. They tell me they're still thinking about it. So it's a winner.
Okay, so on our make-believe holiday table, the cheesecake is there. What else should we make?
I will definitely be making cookies with my niece and nephew.
I love it.
We have to start the Santa tradition. So, and again, I think it's a time where you want to just put a little extra effort in to make something a little bit special. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I can't make a special festive cookie for Christmas, when can I make one? So I have this German chocolate sandwich cookie recipe. Mm. It's a play on a German chocolate cake. So I make a chocolate shortbread cookie that I roll out, and you can, you know, cut it out. And it's these really thin, delicate little cookies that are perfect for sandwich cookies. And, you know, the filling, it's a combination of coconut and the caramel and the pecans. Basically, I'm making the German chocolate cake frosting
that
you use.
Yeah.
And I use it in the filling. I just, you know, I cut up everything a lot more finely so that it will, you know, be nice and smooth in that sandwich cookie.
Oh, I love that.
They're also, you know, if you're going to a cookie party or something, it's a great cookie to bring, because if you get loaded down with cookies, you want some that are going to be really nice and fresh, you know, days later.
I love that. Hey, if you're going to a cookie party, like as you do, like
as one does.
I've never
absolutely.
Been invited to a cookie party before.
Really? Yeah. Holiday cookie swaps. It's totally a thing.
I want to go to a cookie party. That sounds incredible. Right on. Well, okay, what other cookies you got?
Oh, so I have these red velvet thumbprint cookies. And yeah, so these cookies are, again, inspired by a cake. And I actually, they're one of the first holiday cookies that I shared when I got pretty serious on social media. And they are inspired by a Southern Living magazine recipe. And it's like a thumbprint cookie, but you add a little bit of cocoa and a little bit of red food coloring. So you get this gorgeous red color. And, you know, you can use your knuckles or the end of a wooden spoon to get that nice indention in the thumbprint cookie. And one tip is, once the cookies come out of the oven, you can kind of reinforce that indentation.
Okay. Because they'll puff a little bit. So
yes,
it's sort of in the oven.
Exactly. Yeah. But you want, you know, you want that a nice little
divot
surface
in there.
That's going to, yeah, a nice little divot. And then I make, you know, just a simple cream cheese frosting that I pipe right in the center.
Ooh.
It's a nice, like, thick cake-like kind of cookie. And I love that it just, it looks festive. As soon as you see it, you know it's a holiday cookie because of the bright red color. So I think it's a great option for people to bake this holiday.
Okay. So talking to you about cookies makes me remember. So you lived in Paris for a while. And I think, like, if I'm remembering right, like you became sort of obsessed with baking macaron.
This is correct.
Okay. So what was your Christmas time in Paris like? Were you going to like macaron, like swap parties?
Oh my gosh. Christmas time in Paris. It's really special because it's the city of lights.
Mm.
And during the holidays, there are just even more lights everywhere. The windows at the Grand department stores are just so festively decorated. And of course, there are Christmas markets that are selling, you know, all types of candied fruits and fruitcakes. And of course, the Bûche de Noëls. And people are selling vin chaud, which is mulled wine.
Oh,
and it's one
nice.
Of those things I love to make during the holidays. You know, you can take any bottle of red wine. It doesn't have to be a good fancy bottle. And, you know, I add some cinnamon sticks and a little orange juice and some orange peel and even a little like orange liqueur and some other warming spices. Yeah, maybe whole cloves. And I just simmer it on a stovetop with a little bit of honey. And, you know, it says holiday. It says like warm and cozy.
Mm.
And it absolutely reminds me. It just takes me back to like walking down, you know, the cobblestone streets in Paris with that warm cup of mulled wine in my hands.
Oh, that sounds terrific.
It's just, it's the time of year where everything just gets, you know, taken up a notch. And I feel like Paris is its most Parisian self during the holidays.
Oh, I love that. It's like Paris extra.
Exactly.
All right, Valerie, this has been a blast. Thank you so much. Happy holidays to you.
Thank you. It was great speaking with you.
Valerie Lolis is the author of Life is What You Bake It. You can find her recipe for pecan candy cheesecake at splendidtable.org. Coming up, the poet Ada Limón. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful, and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to to a late night PB&J. They even have monthly small batch drops of indulgent treats like 2 gram net carb hero croissant or the 1 gram net carb hero cheddar biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. What a gift to have Ada Limón in our lives. She is a wonderful poet and reader, and getting to listen to her talk and read a poem for a few minutes every day on her podcast, The Slowdown, it just feels so good, especially, you know, at like the quiet moments this time of year. Ada's also a devoted cook, and her food poems are some of my favorites, so we wanted to spend a little time with her. Hi, Ada. It's so great to talk with you.
It's such a pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, thank you. No, we're so psyched for this. We're such fans of yours and The Slowdown, and you know, honestly, I always feel like I never get enough poetry in my life, and getting to listen to you read so beautifully for even just a few minutes each day, it just feels like a special moment, so thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot to hear. Thank you.
No, it's really, really beautiful. And, you know, I also wanted to talk with you because, you know, obviously in addition to festivity and celebration around the holidays, I also think of this time as being a really valuable time for me, and I think a lot of people feel this way too, of a time to reflect and to look forward, which is, you know, what poetry often invites us to do. And to sort of get ready for this conversation, I had the occasion to rewatch a video of you reading poems that you wrote last year for the Southern Foodways Alliance. And it really seemed like you were finding yourself coming back to themes of gardening, you know, which is always sort of inevitably an act of hope, right? And really talking about how food, or writing about how food connects you to people and really connects you to different generations. So how have you been thinking about your food lately?
Oh, that's a beautiful question. I feel like one of the things that really delights me is to think about not just sort of the food that you're eating right in front of you in that moment, but sure, also the way it connects you. I mean, just all full confession that just now I was hungry and I was feeling that kind of like immediate need to get something in my body. And mm-hmm. I cut open, no joke, the most perfect avocado I've ever seen. And it was so beautiful.
Just now, that was the moment?
Just now. And it was so beautiful and like perfect that I was going to do something with it. I was going to put it on a sandwich. I was going to put it in a salad. And instead I just like put a little salt and pepper on it, put a little lime and just ate it right out of the rind. And it immediately brought me back to my childhood in California, being around my mother was always eating avocado. We always laughed that if she didn't know what to make for dinner, the first thing she would say was, "Well, I have an avocado." And that meant we had a base for everything.
Yeah. Turns out your mother was an early millennial.
Yes, totally.
So if food for you was, you know, obviously beyond just deliciousness and beyond nurturing yourself in that moment, like if you were thinking about it so much last year in the height of the pandemic, obviously we're still in the pandemic, who knows when the height is. And you were thinking about it as a sort of way to think about connection and a way to think about hope. Has that change? Has it grown more that way? Has it grown less that way?
I think that it's really grown more of a connection. And I think it's partly because so much of what we had to do, you know, during the height of the pandemic, and like you said, we're still in the middle of it, and so many countries are in the height of it. Mm-hmm. But I do feel like one of the things for me was like going back to the foods that I loved, or being able to call my parents and say, "Oh, I just made this thing that we always used to make together," or, you know, or "Here's a cocktail recipe that my husband and I are making. You should make it." And it is a way for us to feel connected. But it felt more so because we were so isolated from each other. Instead of getting around the table, instead of normally, you know, the traveling I would do back to California, back to New York, all the different places that, you know, we have family, it feels like there's a certain amount of here making that connection that, okay, we're in Kentucky, but how can we stay connected in that sensorial way. So it's not mm-hmm. just a way of talking about it, but, oh, you know, this is delicious. And I was laughing that almost all our Christmas presents last year were like food items, drink items. Like, it was good wine from California. We have an amazing cidery here, Wise Words Cider. And we sent this great cider everywhere. You know, I felt like we were just like, we just wanted to send things that were not stuff, but things you could consume and enjoy and savor together. And yeah, I feel that has remained a big part of our lives right now. It's actually one of the for me, something that I want to hold on to going forward, no matter how the next couple years unfold.
Yeah. And, no one really needs to make a case for why getting together with people and eating and drinking with them is good. Like, that's pretty obvious. But it's so interesting. I just this afternoon heard an interview with a person who wrote this book about fun, like how to have fun and why to have fun. And she started writing this book. Apparently she signed the contract for this book in April of 2020. Mm. And was like, wow, okay, so I now have this opportunity to write a book about fun while, like, you know, the pandemic was just starting. So, like, this seems crazy. And she kind of, like, in her research, it sort of steeled her. And she realized that it wasn't frivolous to write about having fun in the middle of a terrible situation. In fact, it was extremely important because your body actually feels it. She was saying, oh, there's actually research to show, like, when you have fun, it's actually good for your health. And she's like, you know, I don't want to be, you know, overstating it, but there is a physical well-being part of it to having fun. And she defined fun as something that allows you to connect with other people and allows you to experience a sense of flow. And by flow, she means where you can kind of lose yourself in activity. You can ignore the world around you. You know, in sports, you know, you're in the zone, but if you can experience that in connection with other people, that's the definition of fun that she talked about, that your body and your mental health really need. And so I think that's actually a really important thing for us to do for ourselves.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And I feel like so much of our job right now, and maybe just as human beings living in the world in general, is to be present, right? Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to do. And I know that as a poet, it's what I'm always focusing on. Like, I laugh that as we go through that sort of, okay, now we're on Zoom calls, or, you know, we have to be flexible in this way. But I started doing this thing before I taught and before I would give readings, where I would just put my hand over my heart and I would say, okay, be present and enjoy this.
Mm.
And it really, really works. Like, I can't even tell you how many times I just think, right, like, this is a gift. I get to read poems. You know, that's a dream.
Yeah.
Or I get to talk about poetry or teach poetry. And then as, you know, my husband and I would start to travel a little bit more after we got our vaccination, et cetera, we would start doing it as a mantra for even gatherings, or we'd be a little stressed about travel. And then it would just be like, okay, nope, be present and enjoy this. The same thing with food, right? Like, you're sort of stressed about this and that and that. It's like, no, be present and enjoy this. And it's just turned into, I think, you know, really since the early days of the pandemic, it's turned into the sort of the through line of our lives together, and that we just keep repeating it to each other to kind of keep us grounded and also keep us turning towards the light.
Mm-hmm. So as someone who loves cooking and loves eating and loves sharing, what do you have on your holiday table? What are you excited for?
Yeah, well, the joke in my family is that I'm sort of like, I don't dislike turkey. I think turkey's lovely. But for me,
there's so many caveats around our relationships with turkey.
I know everyone has their weird relationship with turkey. But my thing is that I love turkey enchiladas. Like, that is for me, it's like the day after. I'm like all in. Like, let me make the leftovers. Like I excel at the turkey enchiladas, not just making them, but also eating them.
Yeah. How do you do them? How do you do your turkey enchiladas?
We do them. I always do the very simple sort of the two, two, and two. You know, I laugh like it's like 2 tablespoons of, you know, olive oil, 2 tablespoons of cassava flour, 2 tablespoons of chili powder, good chili powder from New Mexico, like the ancho chili powder. And then, you know, after you let that simmer for a while, then 2 cups of broth and you can thicken. You can add tomato paste if you like that as well.
And so that's the sauce.
But, you know, it's all just very simple. And then I just do the, you know, I warm up the turkey with onions and garlic and herbs and then put all of that in either a corn tortilla or like a cassava flour tortilla.
Oh, wow.
And they're my favorite.
Oh, that sounds
so,
so
simple,
good.
But like delicious. I can't recommend them enough.
Yeah, I love that. And again, it's the next day, so you're ready to like reset. Like you have your butter, you had your cream. Yeah. Let's get some chilies now.
Let's get some enchiladas.
Yeah, let's get some chilies back in our bodies. What else? What else do you love for the holidays?
Well, we always, if we are lucky enough to be in California with my family, one of the things that we adore is to do, fresh crab because it's crab season. Dungeness crab season out in California. My family lives in Sonoma, California, the city of Sonoma. And, so there's, you know, if the crab is fresh and the season is happening, I know sometimes there's, I think last year there were some boating issues there were whales in the bay. And so they weren't letting the boats go out, which to protect the whales, which is kind of lovely. So, but for us, it's always like, oh, as soon as there's crab in, it's, you know, ever since we were kids, we would cover the whole table with newspapers and get the, you know, steam the crab lightly just to kind of heat it up a little bit, give it some life. And then have this amazing spread of fresh crab. Everyone has their own crackers. And I'm saying crab crackers. And I, you know, my mom would make a Caesar salad and it was crab Caesar salad. And, the adults of course would have champagne and we would have, you know, sparkling cider or whatever. But it's still one of my favorite, like New Year's traditions was to always, just celebrate that for freshness of the sea.
Oh, that's so cool. You know, I'm jealous. So, hey, because I have you here, and I'm sorry to put you out if it is putting you out, but will you read a poem for us?
Yeah. I would be honored to read a poem. And I thought I would read a newer poem. And one of the things that... I mean, it's connecting it to food or connecting it to this sort of this time that we're all in. It makes me realize that so many of us have so many different types of traditions because we have like a split family or we were, you know, for me, I grew up going from my mom and my stepdad's house to my father and my stepmother's house. And my brother and I would go back and forth every Sunday. And so I remember sort of having 2 Christmases. 2 New Years, 2, like everything was sort of double. And I don't think we talk about that enough because I think so many of us, that's our experiences. And then of course, as you age and if you have a partner, then it can become 4 or 8, you know, like there's all these different traditions. And so this is a poem that will be out in my new book coming out in May. And it's called Joint Custody. Why did I never see it for what it was? Abundance. 2 families, 2 different kitchen tables, 2 sets of rules, 2 creeks, 2 highways, 2 step-parents with their fish tanks or 8 tracks or cigarette smoke or expertise in recipes or reading skills. I cannot reverse it. The record scratched and stopping to that original chaotic track. But let me say, I was taken back and forth on Sundays, and it was not easy, but I was loved each place. And so I have 2 brains now, 2 entirely different brains, the one that always misses where I'm not, the one that is so relieved to finally be home.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Thank you.
And that makes me think of, you know, the fact that so many of us are, you know, if we have family traditions, longstanding traditions, and, you know, they were put on hold last year, and it's a reminder that things are not always and can't always be the way you think they are supposed to be, but there's a value in seeing where you are.
Yeah.
Right?
I think in this poem, it surprised me that I had never thought of it as abundance, that I thought of it as hard work, that, oh, I had to kind of have this, you know, go here and there. And then I thought, no, what a gift. I was thinking even about the choices to, you know, we were trying to figure out if it was safe to travel and if we could keep it, you know, who we can see, etc. And my husband and I kind of looked at each other and it's like, what a gift to not have a bad option. You know, even if it's just the two of us and we stay home, that's still, we'll still make it fun. We'll still make it delightful. And I think that, you know, going back to the be present and enjoy this, I think my younger self, it took me a while to recognize, like, having these two families and two households was a gift.
Yeah. What a beautiful moment of realization. Thank you so much, Ada. Happy holidays.
Oh, thank you. Happy holidays to you.
Ada Limon is the host of the daily poetry podcast, The Slowdown, and she's the author of The Carrying, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award. She's also a National Book Award finalist for Bright Dead Things, and she's a new forthcoming collection of poetry coming out called The Hurting Kind. And that's it for this week. And hey, no matter what you celebrate this time of year, we hope you have a time to slow down for a bit. Stay safe, take care of each other, and have wonderful holidays from all of us at The Splendid Table. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table was created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lupke, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.